You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape, and this is This Week in Cardiology for February 5th, 2016. This week, I'm going to talk about the controversies over the ROCKET-AF trial and Dr. Robert Califf's nomination for FDA commissioner, the treatment of acute coronary syndrome, and the treatment of blood glucose after cardiac surgery. First topic is the controversy over the ROCKET-AF trial. The 14,000 patient strong, multi-center ROCKET-AF trial compared rivaroxaban to warfarin in patients with non-valvular AF. Rivaroxaban was found to be non-inferior to warfarin, and there was not an increase in major bleeding. This single trial led to FDA approval, albeit with some controversy at the time, and now rivaroxaban, the once-daily drug, is one of the most popular direct oral anticoagulant drugs. But controversy has come back. The point-of-care INR test that was used, the machine that was used in this trial, has been subject to a Class 1 FDA recall, the most serious kind of recall. The device may have led to inaccurately low INR readings in certain types of conditions, that is a low crit, high crit, or patients with high fibrinogen levels such as seen in infection or inflammatory conditions. Now, obviously, a spuriously low INR would lead to updosing of warfarin and possible overexposure to anticoagulation. That's a big development because that issue of anticoagulation was the main criticism with ROCKET-AF, namely that less than skillful warfarin use, as evidenced by a TTR of 55%, combined with a high-risk patient cohort, average CHADS 3.5, possibly stacked the deck in favor of rivaroxaban. Now, a couple of months ago, this news came out, and it sent the Duke Clinical Research Institute researchers back to their database. This week, writing in the New England Journal, they presented their post hoc analysis. And basically, they looked at those patients who could have been affected by the recall, up to 37% of the whole cohort, compared with those patients not affected by the recall to see if there was a difference in outcomes. After this extensive analysis, they upheld the main findings of ROCKET-AF, that rivaroxaban was non-inferior to warfarin, and there was not a significant increase in bleeding. This was an impressive analysis, but it's unlikely to squelch doubt. Deborah Cohen, who's an associate editor of the British Medical Journal, published a feature investigation in that journal, and she used amazingly clear language without journal jargon to make the case that ROCKET-AF should be independently analyzed. Cohen and other experts call for a release of the data, open data. Dr. Harlan Krumholz from the Yale Open Data Project said in that letter that he has permission from Johnson & Johnson, that Johnson & Johnson says they will release the data. But rivaroxaban is also owned by Bayer, and Bayer has not given permission to release the data. Now, I don't know what to make of this. On the one hand, the news certainly casts doubt. Think about it. This was a single trial that led to FDA approval. Why won't Bayer release the data? Is there something to hide? But on the other hand, my experience and my colleagues' experience is that rivaroxaban is effective and safe. And I would point you to first think about the data with cardioversion and AF ablation. These are procedures that surely require adequate anticoagulation, and we've not seen a signal of harm. And if rivaroxaban was ineffective, you would think you would see something from these trials. And also, this is just an impression from my clinical practice. It doesn't seem to me that rivaroxaban is any riskier than other direct oral anticoagulants or warfarin. I take care of a lot of patients with AF, and I'm not seeing problems. But stay tuned, please. This story has more chapters. Next story, the Dr. Robert Califf nomination for FDA commissioner. The American Heart Association, ACC, New England Journal, and a host of other professional societies strongly support Dr. Robert Califf for FDA commissioner. And his nomination process had been going beautifully. Now, that was until recently when a number of Democrats have placed holds on the nomination and threatened filibuster. This is a remarkable turn of events. And remember that Dr. Robert Califf was the senior investigator of the Rocket AF trial. Why is this happening? Now, it's been true that there's been a small but vocal voice group of people who have opposed the Califf nomination on the basis of his ties to pharmaceutical industry. But these voices have been drowned out from the universal support that he had from the highest powers of medicine. Now, maybe this is just Democrat versus Republican politics, but maybe there's something about him being an ultimate insider that's working against them. And again, this story has more chapters, so stay tuned. Third topic is the approach to the acute coronary syndrome in the elderly. Here's the headline: Early Invasive ACS Best in the Very Elderly. This was an RCT, and it was published in The Lancet. It was carried out in multiple centers in Norway. Elderly patients who presented with non-STEMI or unstable angina were randomized to early invasive strategy or conservative medical strategy. After 1.5 years of average follow-up, the findings favored the invasive strategy. Ah, but then there are the details. First detail: the researchers screened more than 4,000 patients to get to 228 in each arm. So that's that makes it difficult to generalize to the wide swath of elderly patients that present with ACS. The second problem was the primary composite endpoint. This was a composite of new MI, need for urgent revascularization, stroke, and death. And the benefit of the composite endpoint was driven by the softer parts of this composite, and that is need for urgent revascularization and new MI. And that's a problem for two reasons. First is that the need for urgent revascularizations is an obvious thing, right? If you're managing the patient conservatively, you manage conservatively and you do catheterizations for patients who don't stabilize. That's part of the deal. So it's not a surprise that that's higher. The second problem with this composite endpoint is the new MI. New MIs are difficult to diagnose in people who have MIs. You have to look at changes in troponin, new wall motion abnormalities. It's fuzzy in real life. And by the way, this criticism about composite endpoints and making the diagnosis of new MI is the same criticism I have for a similar single-center trial from Serbia, which was published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology recently. And I realize that I'm pedaling against severe headwinds here. I know. But these studies do not convince me that a conservative initial strategy of medical treatment with intervention in those who do not stabilize or have high-risk stress tests is inferior. The next topic is post-cardiac surgery blood glucose. At my hospital, we use a post-cardiac surgery protocol that keeps blood sugar less than 180 in all patients. That's because stress-induced hyperglycemia is associated with worse outcomes after cardiac surgery. But a new study suggests that we might want to rethink this, or at least go slowly. A group of researchers extracted data from the Cardiothoracic Surgical Trials Network on more than 4,300 patients, and they found that there were three types of patients that react differently based on whether they have diabetes, based on their diabetes status when they present for cardiac surgery. So first, patients with insulin-dependent diabetes had optimal outcomes, less infections, respiratory complications, lower cost, and shorter length of stays if their max glucose was kept between 180 and 240. But patients who, without diabetes, had worse outcomes in longer and costlier missions if their max glucose rose above 180. And patients with non-insulin dependent diabetes fell in between with outcomes and length of stay and cost similar whether or not they had blood glucoses above 180. In short, most patients did better with blood sugars less than 180, except those who came into the hospital on insulin. Now, I talked to a diabetes doctor at my hospital, and he said that this is new news. He was surprised by it. Of course, this was an observational trial, and these findings are best for generating hypotheses of new RCTs, which to me would seem both doable and wise. Next topic is, do you admit to the telemetry unit, step-down unit, or CCU in patients who present with stable ACS? Now, it used to be that all patients with unstable angina went to the CCU. In the day before reperfusion therapy, and yes, I'm old enough to remember those days, complications of MI were common, and so it was good to be in the CCU. But now, currently, with all the changes, it's hard for me to remember the last time I saw a complication of an MI. So it's no surprise, then, that a study of more than 8,000 ACS patients from an Alberta, Canada group found no differences in outcome whether patients were admitted to the CCU or a step-down unit. I mentioned this study, and I like this study for two reasons. First is that ICU and CCU costs are enormous, and it's good that we should seek to avoid wasteful spending. But the second reason I like this study is that ICUs and CCUs are much harder places to heal mentally, physically, and emotionally. Look, if you need hemodynamic support 24 hours, the ICU is the place to be. But otherwise, the noises and the constant interruptions and the hyper-alert culture of the ICU and CCU is the antithesis of a healing environment. So I like to get my patients out of the ICU as fast as possible. So that's it for this week in cardiology. Now remember that this podcast and other podcasts can be listened to and viewed at www.medscape/TWIC. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.